You know, I got kicked out of my house when I was 18 and I ended up homeless and in jail. I was arrested and tried for a crime I didn't commit. I had a very messy few years after high school. And even in my childhood, we were poor and I had, you know, parents who were not really parents and, you know, a real mess. So, you know, to the fact that I'm a teacher and a writer today, I see as a miracle because it was like a dream, but not the dream that would ever come true. The storytelling is there.
Welcome everyone to Learn, Speak, Teach, powered by Baubert Marketing, LLC. If you love to learn, be inspired, and succeed, we're here to speak and teach. I'm your host, Ben Albert. I believe if you're not living, you're dying. If you're not growing, you're withering. And if you're not engaged, you can turn this off right now. Because we here at LST are lifelong learners. And listen, I'm not your guru. I'm an ordinary guy on a journey to learn from the experts. My goal is to host each conversation with a beginner's mindset, learn, and let the experts speak and teach their truths. Join us! Oh yeah, and don't forget to subscribe. This episode is brought to you completely free. Get some stake in the game here. My fee for the show only takes a few moments. If you gain value from the episode, personally share with a friend and explain your favorite part. Bonus points. Please leave us a review on Apple, Google Podcasts, or anywhere you listen to the show. All right, let's get started. I am here with Matthew Dix. Matthew, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm excited. For reasons that the audience are going to... this is going to be incredible. And to read your bio... you're a novelist. Seven novels, is that right?
Seven novels, yeah, that's correct.
So yep. You're a novelist translated into 25 languages worldwide. You're a storyteller, a columnist, a playwright, a blogger, a podcaster, a kindergarten teacher. You won the...
No, that's not true.
No?
That one's not true. I'm a fifth grade teacher. My wife is the kindergarten teacher.
Got it. You are a fifth grade teacher. You and your wife, who's a kindergarten teacher, you guys co-host a podcast.
We do.
And wow, I mean, you're a TEDx speaker. I first discovered you through that TED Talk Homework for Life. And I've been doing my homework for about a month now. So we'll want to dive into that. But I'm tremendously excited because as your resume shows, you're one of the best storytellers in the world right now. And
it's very kind of you. Thank you.
And I'm excited really just to learn about storytelling and learn about what brought you here today. Let's get started with Homework for Life, because that is your famous TED Talk. What is Homework for Life? If someone hasn't seen the talk yet, what is this Homework for Life thing?
Well, the first thing I always like to say is whether you're going to be a storyteller or just a human being, I think you should be doing Homework for Life. I have my 10-year-old students doing it right now, and there's no stages for them in the future, but they're embracing it. So everyone does if they're smart. Basically, I was telling stories on stages around the world early on in my career, and I had a list of stories that I planned on eventually getting to, and that list was getting shorter by the day. And I didn't want to become one of those storytellers who sort of rolls out one of the same 12 chestnuts every night. I know those people, and those were lovely chestnuts, but after you've heard them once or twice, you just don't want to hear them anymore. I wanted to be someone who could take a brand new story to the stage every single time, you know, he was in a new city or a new venue. And so being an elementary school teacher, I gave myself this homework assignment. My goal was at the end of every day, this is basically the assignment I'm now giving your audience. At the end of every day, before you sort of go to bed, I sat down and I asked myself, what was the most story-worthy moment from my day? Which really is to say, even if my day was mundane and boring and nothing really significant happened, what is the most significant thing from the catalog of insignificant things that took place that day that I could put into my homework for life? The real question I asked myself is, if someone kidnapped my family, and they would not give the family back until I told a story about something that happened today, what would I choose? And then I write it down. I don't write down the whole thing because that's insanity. Those are journalers. Those are people who have diaries. They tend to do a really good job when someone dumps them. They fill their diary with words. And then as soon as they find love again, the diary tends to fall into the drawer. I wanted to create something for myself and now something for other people that's easily repeatable every single day, no matter what you're doing. I want it to be like brushing your teeth. I want it to be that automatic. And so I have an Excel spreadsheet. It's a two columns, simple sheet. It's got the date on the left. And then I stretch that B column, that second column, across the screen. And in that B column, I write my story for the day, which really means 3, 4, 5 sentences at the most that capture a moment from the day. My goal was 1 new story per month. That's what I was hoping for. 1 new story a month, 12 new stories a year. I thought that would have been an amazing accomplishment. Instead, something sort of amazing happens. I discover that my life, and I discover subsequently that everyone's lives are filled with stories, that we constantly have moments that are worth talking about, sharing with others, even speaking about on stages. The tragedy of our lives is that we live a day, something happens. Sometimes we're fortunate enough to see it. Sometimes we don't, because we haven't been doing homework for life yet. We haven't developed this lens for seeing things. But even when we do see these moments, we take note of them for a moment, and then we walk on and we forget them. And pretty soon, an entire year of our life can go by, and we have a hard time saying more than 10 things about it. And that is the tragedy of our lives. That is why parents think their children grow up overnight. They don't. We just fail to take note of the moments. We fail to write them down in a way that we can remember them later on. You know, we walk past a quarter on the street, pick it up, put it in our pocket like it's worth something. But someone says something glorious or terrible or interesting or brilliant to us, and we think, well, that was great. And then we move on. And so homework for life doesn't allow you to do that. It doesn't allow you to lose a day, you know, and all you have to do, if you're wondering, you know, if homework for life works for you, just ask yourself, what did you do last Tuesday? Do you have a single memory from a week ago? And oftentimes no one can remember a damn thing from a day that happened a week ago. Right. Or you play this awful game. You say, take your age, whatever it is, I'm 50, subtract 12. Right? So subtracting 12, I'm 38. That's the number I'm dealing with. Whatever number you're dealing with, ask yourself now, how much can you tell me about that year of your life? You went around the sun, 365 days. How many actual stories or memories or things can you speak about from that year of your life? Sometimes people can't say anything and they cry in my workshops because they realize they've lost an entire year of their life because they didn't take a moment to take note of the things that were happening. So homework for life demands that you take note of every day in some small way. But also through that process, I discovered this lens, and it's not just me. Thousands of people do homework for life now all over the world, and they report back to me and say, I now see my life in a new way. So that is the homework assignment I give to everyone. You should start it tonight if you're listening to me. If you don't do homework for life, it's fine. A lot of people in this world suck. And you can just be one of those people. You can be one of those people who don't change their life. You can brush your teeth and go to bed and let another day slip by. But I don't recommend it. I think you should do it.
I agree. And I'll tell you, you know, I've been journaling, gratitude journal. I've been doing this for a while. But then homework for life opened my mind up to storytelling. And, you know, in terms of a gratitude journal, I had a similar experience where lots of negative things would happen and you'd complain and you'd pout and you'd forget about all these positive things that happened in the day. And then the gratitude journal was great in recognizing the little wins and the positive things that happened during the day. Where I'm struggling with homework for life is, what do I put down? Most of my days are very mundane. And I find that I'm jotting down, for example, I'm in a mentorship group and there's 5 new people in the group and they're all with the same company, which was great because there's 5 new people, but kind of lame because they're all from the same company. So you don't have as much variety of voices in the group right now. And that seemed pretty mundane. And that's what I wrote down for my homework for life for yesterday. Is there something that I'm missing to make my homework for life entries come out, to make my stories better, to make it less mundane? Or do I just maybe have a mundane life?
Well, I'll say 2 things. First, you haven't been doing it long enough to really have developed that lens yet. You know, I used to be looking for big, extraordinary, story-worthy moments in my homework for life early on and would often be disappointed when I couldn't find them. What I've discovered is that is not what will ultimately be the case for you. Eventually, you will start to see things that you just can't see right now. But the other thing is, you can't judge what you're writing down on a daily basis. My favorite example is this past spring, back in May, I had a Homework for Life entry that said, dinner on the patio with the neighbors tonight, first dinner outside of the spring. And that's all I had. And I remember when I wrote it, I thought, well, that's not going to go anywhere, right? So 2 months later, it's July now, or it's the end of June, beginning of July, and I find out that these neighbors, they're two very close friends of ours. They live on either side of us. I find out within a week that both couples are divorcing and that they've been going through struggles for the last year or more. And suddenly I realized that that night on the patio, which thank goodness I took note of, because I would have otherwise just said, that's boring and stupid, don't write anything down. Suddenly I realized that that night on the patio, there were three couples and only one of them was actually happy. The other two couples were pretending to be happy for our benefit, enjoying my cheeseburgers and hot dogs. But when they retired to their own homes, they returned to strife and anger and eventually discord. And I just thought that was a wonderful moment for me to recognize. And I think that can be a story. It's a story about how you never know what's going on inside someone's house. Even when they're standing right in front of you and they're holding hands and they're kissing each other, they can retire to their homes and hate each other, and you'll have no idea that that's happening. And it was so devastating for us to think that these two couples were getting divorced and that they might move away because they both have small children who play with our children. And we basically have three houses with one backyard, one shared backyard. And we thought, this is all going to be gone. Now, thankfully, both couples have decided to retain the house. Someone moved out in both cases, but the kids and one of the parents are going to remain, and it's going to work out. But had I not written down that May evening on the patio, I would not remember it today. It would absolutely be gone from my memory. But now it's the beginning of a story. The thing is, we never know when we're in the middle of a story. We don't understand that, like, something that's happening now will 3 months ago resonate for us, or 3 years from now will resonate. So we just write down what we think is the most story-worthy thing, trusting that we're capturing our days. And even if that moment meant nothing, I'm still not losing a day. I can still remember that night in May with great clarity, sitting with that couple on that beautiful night. I remember the moon was in the sky early that night. I just remember details.
Yeah.
And, you know, 100 years from now when I'm gone, my Homework for Life is still going to exist. And my great-great-grandchildren are going to know about a night in May when I sat with couples on a patio and looked at a moon and ate cheeseburgers. And I think that's kind of extraordinary too. I would love to know what my great-great-grandfather was doing 100 years ago. And I have no clue about anything from his life, because what most people, 99.999% of people do, is they live their lives and then they die. And within 100 years, they are forgotten completely, as if they never existed on this planet. And so if we can leave something behind too for future generations, even if we don't want to mythologize ourselves, we can leave something for the people who actually want to know something about us. That is another value of Homework for Life.
It's very valuable. And again, never missing a day. I like to joke about, you know, when artificial intelligence gets to a point where it's possible, they could completely create a spitting image of me based on the amount of information I'm documenting on myself. But I don't want to digress too much, because that's a crazy thought. I'm a little neurotic and I have some of these crazy thoughts, and sometimes I'll embellish. I guess a two-part question is, how do you avoid embellishing and kind of adding a creative twist? And to avoid doing that and embellishing these stories, like, how do I know what to look for? How do I know what to focus on? What lens do I need to wear when I begin the day?
Well, I don't embellish on stories. I think the thing that I have that's an advantage is, because I'm a novelist, I'm in the business of making up stories from whole cloth all the time. So when it comes to my personal stories, what I love to do is think of them as puzzles. I am laden by facts that are immutable and unchangeable. This is the story. These are the things that happened. I can't change any of them. What I can do is decide what order to put them in, what importance to place them. I can take things out of stories that don't help me. I can remove people who don't service the story in some way, or I can compress time a little bit to make things a little more palatable to an audience. But I've never added anything into a story that didn't actually happen. I've never added a twist that wasn't really there, because it would just seem too easy sort of to just throw in something that would make the story more interesting. That's what I do with novels. Like, I just throw in things that would make it sound more interesting. So I love the puzzle nature of storytelling. The idea that I have to assemble this thing in a way that's going to be most entertaining and connective. You know, in terms of sort of developing that lens, you know, I think fundamentally that all stories are about change. You know, they're about a singular moment in our lives when we change in some way. I tend to think it's going to be transformation, which is I change as a person in some way, or realization, I change my mind about something in a certain way. And so those are the moments I'm really looking for. I'm looking for the moments when I suddenly see the world differently, or I feel differently about myself or about another person. And those changes can be really small. And I love the small stories. They're my favorite stories to tell, is the little ones. So, you know, the lens you want to have is, oh, I suddenly think a little differently than I did yesterday, or I suddenly feel a little differently, or I'm actually a little bit different of a person now than I was a minute ago. Those are the kinds of things I'm looking for.
When you have that lens on, and when you look back on months, how long have you been doing Homework for Life yourself, Matthew?
Just over 8 years now.
So just over 8 years of data. And wow, like, when you do you see certain trends? Are you like me where you change your mind every couple weeks and you have a new idea? You got shiny object syndrome and you're always moving on to something else. Are you consistent? What have you discovered, you know, maybe psychologically about yourself and about your reaction to these events and about the analysis of all this homework you're doing for life? Have you discovered anything you never would have expected?
Well, I see patterns in my life that I didn't know existed, and they often become stories. You know, the one that people like the most is, I always tell people my wife and I don't fight, and we really don't. We've never raised our voices to each other. We've never really had an argument. We were friends before we, you know, had a relationship, and we watch television holding hands. Quite literally, when we sit on the couch and watch television, we sit next to each other and hold our hands. It's really sick. But I would tell people we don't fight. And then there was a time when I was going through my Homework for Life, and I saw an entry where my wife wanted me to put the air conditioners into the windows because it was getting hot. I now have central air because I couldn't do it anymore. But back then, she said, can you put the air conditioners in? And she always chose the hottest day of the year because that's when she wanted them. And every year, for some reason, the air conditioners kept getting heavier. I don't know how that happened, but they did. So, you know, she asked me to do that. And I said, it's really hot today and I'm busy. And she went, okay, no problem. And then I sat there and stewed for a little bit. And then I went downstairs and I got the air conditioners and I banged them intentionally as I came up the stairs and I jammed them in the windows and I made a lot of noise. And she was saying, are you all right? And I'm like, I'm fine. I'm putting in the air conditioners, you know? And then everything was fine. She wasn't even aware of what was going on. And then in my Homework for Life, 3 weeks later, there's an entry about her asking me to mow the lawn on, again, the hottest day of the year. And now I have a lawn service, so I've eliminated that problem too. But she says, can you mow the lawn? And I said, you know what? It's the hottest day. Why do you ask me on the hottest day? She goes, no, it's no problem. Just do it on another day instead. And I sit there and I stew and I get mad. And then I go outside, I grab the lawnmower and I like angrily cut our lawn. And so I've noticed these things and there's more. And what I notice is I kind of fight with my wife. I've been telling people all my life I don't fight with her, but I do fight with her. I fight with her by like angrily doing the chores that I don't want to do that she's asked me to do in a way that she's not even aware is happening. And when I crafted that into a story, married couples just thought it was the funniest thing in the world because they all acknowledged that they do these things and it immediately made them feel more human and more relatable and not as bad about, you know, the things they're doing. So I noticed patterns throughout my life in that way. And the other thing I've noticed just really clearly is that a lot of the most significant realizations of my life is my wife telling me something about me that I didn't know. That pops up in my Homework for Life all the time. She says something and it's like it was sitting in front of me the whole time, but I couldn't see it. And as soon as she says it, it's like the blanket has been removed and suddenly it's staring me in the eye. So those are the two things I really noticed through Homework for Life. But it's a joy to go back and look. I'll tell you, it's just so much fun to relive a year. It's great.
Yeah, I've been doing mine in a tablet because my goal long term is you write in this tablet and then it converts it to text. And I want to type in certain words and see if there's certain themes or tropes in my life long term by kind of keeping this, because I like writing, but I like that it converts it to text so I can look at it long term.
Yeah, that's great.
I don't know what to expect. I think that my entries thus far are very boring. I think that so I'm in marketing, I'm in sales, and I tell stories all the time. I don't think they're that good. Is there certain things that people just really are stinky at? Are there certain things that I should be trying to do? You know, I have a story about starting my business last year during COVID, and the whole story of what brought me to today. And people love that success story, but I feel like it's very systematic. It's very much a chronological, this is what I happened, this is what I did, this was the revenue that I drew. It's very systematic.
Yeah.
That can't be the right way, is it?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. I think the problem that people have with storytelling is we tell almost all of our stories to people who love us, our relatives or our friends, and they have infinite patience with our stories. And so what happens is we tell a story poorly and they demonstrate like appreciation for it because they listened and they smiled and they nodded and they said something nice. And so what happens is we get bad feedback on poor storytelling. We tell bad stories and we think we're doing well. The only way you can really know if you're telling a good story is you have to stand in front of 200 strangers and tell that story. You have to find people who are uninterested, disengaged, and, you know, lacking compassion for you, and then see if you can entertain them. Because the ultimate goal of a story, above all others, is it has to be entertaining. Because if you're not entertaining, people don't listen. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons that I tell stories, and many of them are much more important than being entertaining. But entertaining is first, because otherwise nothing else can flow after that. And so when I'm telling a story or when I'm crafting a story to be told, I am constantly thinking about the person who doesn't care about me. Are they interested right now? The word I like to focus in on is wonder. Is my audience wondering what is going to happen next? And if they're not, I have failed. Twice in my life, I've gone to a movie and the power's gone out in the middle of the movie. I don't know if this ever happened to you. And the first time it happened, I was with my daughter. Power goes out. Manager comes in and says, you can come back tomorrow and see the movie again if you'd like or whenever you want. I never went back because I wasn't wondering what was going to happen next. I didn't care about the characters on the screen. They could all die. I didn't care. So we never went back. We were like, whatever happens, we don't care. The second time it happened, we were back the next day because we couldn't stand not knowing what the next thing was going to be in the movie. That's what I try to do with my stories. I want a story to be so compelling that if the power goes out and I disappear, the audience is frustrated by the fact they can't hear the rest of the story. That is the goal I set. Now, that's a high bar. Yes. It's difficult to achieve, but I don't think it's what most people think when they're crafting stories. I think most people think, I want to describe it well. I want to say nice things. I want to put good sentences together. And none of that matters. None of it matters at all. There's, you know, there's a woman in New York who kicks my butt all the time. Her name's Marta, in storytelling competitions. And English is her third language. And none of her verbs and nouns agree. And her vocabulary is limited, but she kicks my ass all the time because she understands how to keep an audience on the edge of their seats. And so that's what you need to do.
Wow.
That's all.
You weren't incredible at this the first time you did it, I imagine. It took a lot of repetition and practice and feedback doing stories in front of people that didn't know you, maybe didn't like you, maybe they're competitors. And now you've won 50, you know, moth slams. For anyone who doesn't know what the moth is, give us like a very bird's eye view, a quick, you know, explanation of what the moth is.
Sure. Well, there's lots of storytelling organizations in the world now, including the one my wife and I run, but that's the granddaddy of them all. That's the storytelling organization in 1997 that said, we're going to have true stories told live to audiences without any notes in bars and bookstores and theaters and places like that. Started in New York. And so now they produce shows in big theaters where you a much more formal story, or story slams, which I also go to, which are those competitive, you drop your name in a hat, maybe your name comes out, you take the stage, you tell a story, a team of judges decides whose story is best at the end of the night, you go on to a championship and compete against other winning storytellers. So it's an organization dedicated to storytelling, and they do a good job of it. So I got my start with the Moth for many, many years. All I did was go to New York and Boston and perform on stages there for the Moth before I sort of started to expand my base.
So you get on stage at a moth slam. No one knows you, maybe other than your wife, your mom, a couple people. But most people are competitors. They don't know you. They might not even like you. Maybe they've been drinking. You need to win these people over. Are you like me where you're breaking a sweat every single time? Like, what is that experience like? And how do you captivate that audience? Is it tonality? Like, what is it?
Well, it's a whole bunch of things. I'm fortunate. I don't get nervous. You know, I was very good right from the beginning. I won my first slam.
Wow.
And I used to think I had just fallen into something I was good at. Then my wife one day pointed out, I've been writing stories since I was 17 years old and I've published novels. So I understand how story works. So when I hear a story and I turn to my wife and say, why would they use that type of chronology in the story? She goes, I don't know, maybe because you've been working in stories for 25 years and they got their start 25 minutes ago. So that makes sense. I've also been a wedding DJ for more than 20 years. So I am accustomed to standing in front of large groups of people and speaking extemporaneously, especially large groups of like partially drunk, disinterested human beings who are really interested in having a good time and not listening to the DJ. So I've got that, you know, that experience. And I've been an elementary school teacher. The worst audience in the world are 10-year-olds. And so I've learned lots of tricks in order to hold an audience's attention. And it turns out that the tricks I learned using 10-year-olds, they're the same tricks I use on stages today. It's one and the same. So it's a lot of things. Like tonality is one of those things. The understanding of how to use a microphone is really important. But it really starts with crafting a story right from the very first sentence that is going to engage an audience, entertain an audience, mean something to an audience. You know, the best version of every story is the storyteller is telling the story, but also simultaneously kind of reliving the moment on behalf of the audience or for the audience. So when I'm telling a story, I sort of stop seeing the audience to a degree and I see my story. And so that means I'm able to react emotionally to the moment, even though that moment might've happened 25 years ago. I'm now back in that moment and you get to watch me react to some degree, you know, in the same way I did back then. So there's a bit of like performance in it. That said, I don't memorize any stories ever. I don't have a single story memorized in any way. So I don't believe in that kind of thing. But I do try to get up and be as entertaining and engaging as possible. Lots of people are nervous though. Almost every person I know is nervous except for me. I'm the worst before a show. You'd never want to be around me. I've been with the best storytellers in the world and they're pacing backstage. And I'm like, hey, how's it going? And they're like, don't talk to me. I'm trying to hold stuff in my head. Yeah. And I've seen them like perform many times brilliantly and they're still freaking out. So it's normal. I always tell people, if you're nervous, you're just like everybody else. You're not special in any way. I'm the only weirdo who doesn't get nervous. And it's probably arrogance, narcissism, and stupidity, you know, that's weaving a blanket that protects me. But most people get nervous. So you just got to get over that and go do the hard thing. Because the hard thing and the right thing are often the same thing.
Hard thing, right thing are often the same thing. Spot on. I love it, Matthew. So most people, they do get nervous. You've just been able to knock it out of the park. Were you born a storyteller? Like, what did you want to be when you grew up? Did you always aspire to be a writer, a storyteller, a speaker? What did you want to be when you were a child?
I didn't picture myself on stages, but when I was little, I used to say I wanted to teach and I wanted to write. And that's basically, that was my goal that I never honestly ever thought would happen. You know, I got kicked out of my house when I was 18 and I ended up homeless and in jail. I was arrested and tried for a crime I didn't commit. I had a very messy few years after high school. And even in my childhood, we were poor and I had, you know, parents who were not really parents and, you know, a real mess. So, you know, to the fact that I'm a teacher and a writer today, I see as a miracle because it was like a dream, but not the dream that would ever come true. The storytelling, the standing on stages, that didn't come till later. And that really was my friends encouraging me to go to New York and tell a story for the Moth. I mean, it was already on stages sort of performing as a wedding DJ. And, you know, I just went back to my Boy Scout camp this past summer and I walked into the dining hall, saw the stage and then suddenly remembered, oh, I used to be the person who would go on the stage and do all the skits and make all the announcements because nobody else wanted to go on the stage. And I always thought, well, I want to go on the stage, you know, and the Saturday night show, I suddenly remembered, oh, I was the MC of the Saturday night show, which was like 500 people in an amphitheater. And I thought nothing of it. So there was that all along. I just didn't know it. You know, the ease that I have in front of other human beings and the ability to sort of just speak was not something I understood I could do, but I now recognize I had been doing for a long time, just without any ambition behind it.
Are you the most interesting man in the world? I mean, tried for a crime that you didn't commit, ambitious storyteller, writer, podcaster. I think I read on the website that you're also an ordained minister.
I am. Yes, and I marry people. I officiate weddings, and I'm actually the substitute minister at Universalist churches. When their minister goes to Florida on vacation, they'll have me come. And even though I tell them, you understand that I don't actually believe in God, I'm the kind of person who wants to believe but can't find faith at this point in his life. And they're like, that's fine. Just come in and tell some good stories. Get us thinking. You can ring the bell, pick a reading. We'll walk you through the steps. And yeah, it's a lifetime that I have spent saying yes to every opportunity, regardless of how crazy or ridiculous or how limited my time was. I always believe in saying yes, because you can always turn a yes into a no later on. But if you start at no, you've closed off an opportunity. And I'm pretty convinced that when I'm 90, people will not be asking me to do the same things that they're asking me at 50. And at 90, I'm going to be angry at the 50-year-old version of myself for saying no to some of those things. So I am preventing the 90-year-old from being angry at me by saying yes to all the things today, which is how I became a minister. My friend said, I'd like you to officiate my wedding. I said, I'm not a minister. You can get ordained online. You can do this stuff. And every day, it seems like someone says, hey, do you want to? And I go, that sounds stupid, but okay, let's see how it works out.
Yeah, let's see how it works. I love how you mentioned you can always turn a yes into a no. You reminded me of something that happened 10 years ago. I'm 20. My girlfriend's 24. We actually leave the bar. We're outside of the fence because we're smoking a little bit of pot. And then the security guard comes out. Wait, I was never in the bar. So the security guard comes out and basically says, what are you guys doing out there? And she's like, my girlfriend's like, we're just coming back in. And he's like, you were out here? And she's like, yes. So she lied. I couldn't get into the bar. I was 20, but all she had to do is say yes. I'm just there frozen, not sure what to say. But it was as simple as saying yes to his question. Then he let us in.
Right.
So you said yes to becoming a minister. And this is, I didn't even know if I wanted to ask you this, but I noticed on the website that you also do exorcisms.
Exorcisms? No, I don't do exorcisms.
I'm not making this up.
I've never done an exorcism.
I wrote once.
Someone once said, would you do an exorcism? And I always say, well, I'd say yes to everything. The only thing I've ever said no to was there's a naked storytelling show in Boston that I've been asked to do where you have to stand on stage naked and tell a story. And as an elementary school teacher, I just don't think that's a good idea for me. Also, based upon like my physique, I just don't think it's going to be good for the audience to have to look at me be naked while I tell a story. But no, I don't do exorcisms yet, although I'm more than willing to try I don't know. I've seen The Exorcist. That's kind of terrifying. But no, I don't do exorcisms.
It made it to your website. I don't know who put it up there or when it went up there, but
that's hilarious.
That would definitely
I'll have to
make
check on that. My assistant will be on that later on today.
my dog's been acting kind of weird, so I might have to hire you.
Well, I'm always willing to say yes. My wife is constantly trying to get me to say no because, you know, I just fill my life. But she'll also tell you that, you know, the thing that I've done that she always thinks is the best is I've made our lives extremely interesting. And the people we've met and the things we've done and the places we've gone have been really extraordinary. So she credits all my yeses while they do irritate her from time to time.
I love it. I mean, you got to keep it interesting. Stories for life, stories every single day. I still can't get over the fact that my life seems mundane. Did you seem to start saying yes? Were you always just saying yes and always an opportunist and always looking to grow and experience? Did Homework for Life open that up to you? Like, did that kind of start that for you? Have you noticed that Homework for Life almost creates an interest and an intrigue that didn't once exist? What's your experience?
No, it wasn't Homework for Life. You know, when I was 22, while I was awaiting trial for the crime I did not commit, just after being homeless, I was living with a family of Jehovah Witnesses in a pantry with a goat which is a whole story in itself. But while I was doing that, I was working two full-time jobs to pay for the attorney that I had to hire in order to prevent me from going to prison. So it was $25,000 for a 22-year-old kid in 1993, which might as well have been $1 million. So I was working two full-time jobs, and one of them was I was managing a McDonald's restaurant in Brockton, Massachusetts. I was working the night shift. I would close the restaurant. And I got robbed one night at gunpoint by people who I knew had already killed other people in other robberies. The police had come and warned me about them. They had actually robbed my girlfriend's McDonald's on the other side of the town a week before. And unfortunately, for reasons I'll never understand, I took the money that we had collected that night, you know, the cash, the receipts, and I had put them in a deposit bag, and I was getting ready to seal that bag up when I heard the glass break and I knew what was happening. And so I dropped that bag down the chute in the back of the safe into a box that I could not open, a box that had a sign that said, manager does not have key. I don't know why I did that, but I did. And they came back into the office and they gathered my crew people and they put us on the ground and they put a gun to my head and they counted back from three and said, they'll kill me at, you know, at zero, they're going to pull the trigger if I don't open that box that I could not open. And the gun was empty. They pulled the trigger and the gun was empty. And then they did it to me again. And they told me this time it was loaded. And I mean, for a very long time, I couldn't say those words. The fact I'm able to say those words to you now is more extraordinary than you could ever imagine. It was years of PTSD and now therapy that allows me to do this. But that is the moment that changes my life. Lying on a greasy towel floor, knowing with certainty that I'm about to die, and thinking about how I've done really nothing with my life up to that point, I understood that at the end of your life, at least for me, and I think probably for most people, actually, if you look into hospice interviews, you'll see it's true. The thing people feel the most at the end of life is regret for opportunities missed, you know, girls they didn't ask out at in high school, vacations they didn't take, children they didn't spend enough time with. And that is the only thing I felt at the end. The fear of being shot in the head was gone. The anger of what was happening to me, the beating I was taking was gone. Everything disappeared except for regret. And so, you know, when I survived that, I committed myself. I'm not really committed myself. I found myself terrified to ever feel that way again, that utter feeling of regret that I have not done everything I could with my life. And so that was the moment that changed everything for me. That was the moment then when I made the decision that being a writer and being a teacher were not pipe dreams, but were going to things I was going to relentlessly chase down until they happened. You know, so that was when everything changed. Homework for Life 8 years ago just allowed me to understand how fleeting time is for us if we don't take account of it. It was the moment when I sort of discovered that I'm just throwing my days away. And I'm going to be that 90-year-old guy looking back, and he's going to have 4 stories or 9 stories. You know, he's going to have 12 things to talk about. You know, those people, like your older relatives, they tell you the same stories over and over again. It's not because they've forgotten that they told you the last time. It's because they don't have anything else to say. It's because they don't have a lot to say because they've just let it all go. You know, there was a moment when they had good things to say and they didn't hold on to it. Now they're 90 and they got nothing. So I don't want to be that guy. So that's what Homework for Life sort of brought to the forefront of my mind. But I was already turned around from that robbery and already, you know, on a path of constant yes and relentless pursuit of, you know, what I wanted. Whether that what I wanted is, I like to be clear, it's being a writer, being a teacher, you know, being a minister, being a DJ, but also being a great father. And being a husband who sits with his wife at night and holds her hand while we watch television together, you know, it's those things too. So while I say I'm relentless in my pursuit of my goals also include spending 20 minutes with my cat today. I'm going to make sure that I spend 20 minutes with my cat on my lap because that makes me feel good. It makes my cat feel good. And someday my cat's not going to be here and I'm going to be happy that I gave my cat at least 20 minutes a day of love, you know? So that's what I talk about in terms of goals. I don't like people to misconstrue the idea of success with career success. It can be whatever you want it to be and whatever you need it to be.
Yes, you're relentless, but you're also humble. You're modest. Your cat, your wife, the little things are what is important in life. And let's talk about the little things. So rapid fire round is basically where I take Family Feud and Whose Line Is It Anyway, and I mash them together. It's okay. Like Family Feud that, you know, we've got a time clock. We're trying to, you know, say the answers as quick as we possibly can. But it's like Whose Line Is It Anyway, that the points are completely subjective to whatever you're interested in. They do not matter. I'm just looking for quick, easy answers to get to know Matthew a little bit better.
Okay. Sound good? Yeah, sounds great. I'm interested.
Coffee or tea? Let's do coffee or tea.
Neither. I've never tasted either one.
And you already got it. You can fill in the blank. You've never tasted either one?
No, I've avoided both because they seem complicated and people's moods seem dependent upon whether they have them or not. And I've never wanted to be the person who was having a bad day because he didn't have his coffee or his tea. So I've never tasted either one of them in my life.
Amen to that. I'm curious now about, I often, my next question is beer or wine. Is it a similar answer?
I don't drink at all anymore, other than a champagne toast, some Prosecco on New Year's. There was a time when it was beer. It was very, very brief. It was never wine. I've never liked the taste of it. I really enjoy the taste of a kamikaze, but I really don't need those anymore either. So I'm pretty boring when it comes to those things. I just don't drink anymore. For a very, very long time, I haven't had much alcohol.
Fair enough. Good stuff. Water is always my go-to at the end of the day. So cats or dogs? You said you had a cat.
I do have cats, but my dog, who's since passed, was my best friend for 18 years. And, you know, I am at his core a dog guy who also loves cats, but dogs.
I'm just thinking to myself, it's hilarious because these are quick, short answers, but I'm talking to a storytelling pro, so you probably could tell a story for a lot of these.
Every single questions.
One. Do you have a favorite season, a favorite time of the year?
Summer. I am an elementary school teacher, and I love my job, but I like summer vacation more.
So a little bit longer answer. If you could sit down with three people, live or dead, and just sit back, relax for an entire evening and tell stories and learn, who would you want at that table?
Winston Churchill, for sure. I think I would probably take Bruce Springsteen, just because it would allow me to be within his company. I'm sure he has good stories. He's an extraordinary writer, actually. That Jerk wrote a really good book, too. So I'll take Churchill. I'll take Springsteen. And I will take, you know who I'd take? Zora Neale Hurston, writer and someone I studied in college quite a bit who, I don't know, always poked me in the, like, the wrong and the right way. So I think I'd take those three. You know what? Let me change that. Nadine Gordimer. I take Nadine Gordimer, South African writer who was instrumental in sort of fighting apartheid. And she actually poked me in the wrong and the right ways even more. So I take her.
One more list. We're going to do books or podcasts, including your own. But let's actually just do books, because I want to know if you were to gift a book, you know, one, two, or three books to an inspiring writer, an inspiring storyteller, or just a student of life, what pops out as a great gift for someone who is that student of life?
Stephen King's On Writing. You should absolutely listen to that book, but reading it is fine too. I've done both many, many times. It's a I return to book. Bill Bryson's The History of Nearly Everything will just cover all the stuff that you missed in high school. It's really, Bill Bryson's brilliant. And that book is just brilliant. I need a third.
Let's do one of your books. Let's do an introduction to one of your books and how I can read that, how I can get it.
Well, Storyworthy is the book you should start with based upon our conversation, which is my storytelling book, which you can get wherever you buy books. Essentially, it's actually what I wanted it to be. Was Stephen King wrote On Writing, which was about writing. I wanted to write Storyworthy as the On Writing version of storytelling, which is a blend of memoir and storytelling advice, both the finding, crafting, and telling of stories. It's broken into those three things, and I weave my life through it. So that's the book from me that I think I would recommend.
That'll be in the show notes. You can get it anywhere. I know that for a fact. And where else, if I want to follow you, is it the website, social media? Where should be the first place I go to just kind of keep up to date on Matthew?
Well, if you go to my website, you can subscribe to my newsletter, which you'll get every couple weeks. And that'll give you most of sort of the things that I'm doing. You can go listen to my wife and my podcast, Speak Up Storytelling. That is storytelling instruction. We play a story from our live shows, and then we deconstruct that story and talk about what's going well and what's not. I also do a Homework for Life segment every week where I take a moment from my Homework for Life and show you how it could be a story. So that might be helpful to you to figure out how those moments can be transformed into stories. So that's a good way to do it too. And then you just go MatthewDix.com and get other things there. There's social media and things like that.
Tremendously helpful. Listen, guys, at least get the newsletter so you can stay up to date every couple of weeks. Pure value. I want to ask one more question. I'm thinking this one through. I want to ask a big one. So you've done a lot of podcasts. You've done a lot of speaking. Is there an incredible question that just blew your mind, and or maybe a question that no one seems to ask you? You get a lot of the same questions, I imagine. Is there a question that really stood out to you, or a question that no one's ever asked that really stood out as a great question? And then obviously, I want to know the answer to that question. Anything from childhood to storytelling to speaking to anything in the life of Mr. Dix that I should have asked you if I knew your psyche a little bit better?
Well, I'll say the question I always like best is the one I've never been asked. And I do like questions out of left field. You know, lots of times podcasters try to send me the questions ahead of time and I don't look at them because I hate that. You should just be able to talk. I guess, you know, I often talk about how I'm not afraid to be on stage. You know, I don't get nervous. And no one's ever flipped that question and said, well, what does make you afraid? You know, what's the thing that you're afraid of if it's not public speaking? Because for most people, it is public speaking. That is their number one fear. And that is not a fear at all of mine. So I guess that's an interesting question, which is what I'm most afraid of. I mean, the answer is probably not that interesting, though. I think it's death, actually. I'm terrified on a constant basis. I think about death more than I think you would ever believe a person could think about death. And I'm sort of, the only way I get through the day is I have tricked myself into sort of believing that I'm going to be the person who never dies. And if I can believe that to the end of the day, and then I can get to sleep quick enough before the thoughts of not existing creep into my brain, I have a good day. So the fact of, not death itself, but the fact that there will be a period of time on this planet that I will not be able to experience and occupy, that is really terrifying to me. And so not the stage, it is the lack of a stage. It is the lack of, you know, being that I think that I am most frightened of.
The lack of a stage, lack of being. I mean, you already told the story. I mean, you had a gun up to your head and they pulled the trigger. So you've been very close to it. Have you dissected why this is such a strong fear of yours?
Well, two times before the gun, oddly enough, I died and paramedics had to use CPR to bring me back to life. I know.
You actually might live forever at this rate.
Well, I've survived too. I got stung by a bee when I was 12 and I didn't know I was allergic. So paramedics found me without a heart rate or a heartbeat. And then I went through a windshield when I was 17 and in the back of an ambulance, I stopped breathing and my heart stopped beating. So you'd think that at that point I would have turned my life around and it wouldn't have taken a robbery 3 years later, but that's what happened. You know, I don't know why. I actually think that everyone's crazy for not being as afraid as I am. I think that probably the truth is, I know what it feels like in the very last seconds. Now, I didn't die that night on the floor in the restaurant, but I thought, I genuinely had no doubt in my mind that this was it. Right. And I know what that feels like. I know what it feels like to think there's nothing beyond the next second. And I think what happens is most people walk through life not thinking about it, not understanding what that actually will feel like when you get to that moment. Now, maybe when you get to that moment, you're 95 and you're so tired, you're just like, that's fine. I'm good to go. I've lived a good life. Maybe that's why we age to a point that we accept it. But if there's a 30-year-old walking around or a 50-year-old walking around and saying they're not afraid of death, I just think you don't know death. You have not actually stood on the edge, because if you have, you should be terrified. So I think that my fear is completely logical and justified, and that people walk through life blind to what the truth is. And I think it's probably the better way to be. I don't think it's great for me to be thinking about death 4 times an hour. But that is the truth of my life, is I contemplate my existence 4 times an hour, probably on average. Now, I think it results in me accomplishing many of the things that I've accomplished, and that's been wonderful for me. But I also know there's a lot of angst behind it, and a lot of nightmares, and a lot of fear. So it's a double-edged sword.
Very powerful. And I'm happy we could have brought joy, intrigue, emotion, everything, the whole gamut to the audience today. I'm tremendously humbled you came on the show. I'm going to subscribe to the newsletter. I'm going to start reading the books. There's 7 of them to get to. They're in the show notes. Thanks again, Matthew. It's been an incredible time, and I truly appreciate you taking the time with me today.
Thank you very much.
Listening to Learn, Speak, Teach, powered by Balbert Marketing, LLC. You need to go subscribe if you haven't yet. This show is completely free. If you gain value from the episode, personally share with a friend and explain your favorite part. Leave us a review on Apple, Google Podcasts, or anywhere you listen to the show. All right. Thanks once more for listening to LST. I am so grateful. Talk to you soon.